Good afternoon. Welcome to Dynamic Health here on CFRO 102.7 FM in Vancouver. My name is John Pranger, and for the time being, I'm your host. Maybe next in the next couple of weeks, we're going to have a meeting, the collective of Dynamic Health, and we'll see if we can sort something out so that we can present these shows in a way that rotates a few people so that you get different viewpoints, and also we hope that Croft is going to join that collective. Now, somebody just gave me the thumbs up for that. Well, it was an open secret in the profession that the great discoverer of vaccination was a disappointing person at close quarters. He was vain, petulant, crafty, and greedy. He had more of grandiloquence and bounce than of solid attainments. In London, at least, his presence was a bore, and his reputation an incubus, which the profession, outside his own small following, would have gladly got rid of. That is from a pamphlet by Dr. Charles Creighton, Jenner and Vaccination, a Strange Chapter in Medical History, published in 1885. Anyone who reads Jenner's alleged inquiry, and I have it right here in front of me, can see that for himself that his specific was not cowpox, but horse grease transferred to the cow by the hands of a dirty milker. Ordinary cowpoxes were spurious, according to him. It was the London doctors Pearson and Woodville who forced the spurious cowpox on the public and on Jenner. They knew the smell of horse grease and wouldn't touch it with the end of a barge pole. So spoke Lionel Dole. In 1811, there had occurred a notable instance of failure. Lord Robert Grosvenor, 10 years of age, who had been vaccinated by Jenner himself and so should have had lifetime immunity, according to Jenner's dictum, was now taken with smallpox and lay hovering between life and death. Jenner sat by the bedside of his illustrious patient, and when at last the boy began to turn and get better, Jenner turned to the father with what a lucky job he was vaccinated. If he had not been, he would surely have died. And thus Jenner started the glorious doctrine of mitigation, which has been handed down as the heirloom of the medical vaccinationist ever since. And that's according to Dr. Hadwin. And a Dr. Ward of the Pathology Department of the University of Hong Kong wrote in a letter to Dr. Calacarinos, "Like you, I do not worship Louis Pasteur, and I considered Edward Jenner to be one of the great criminals of history." Well, where are we here? Darn it, there we go. For a practice as universally damaging as vaccination is to persist and hold public approval, it must do so on the strength of deception and cleverly concealed facts. Dr. Herbert M. Shelton, in his textbook Basic Principles of Natural Healing, gives us a clear idea of the situation when he says medical facts are unlike any other facts in the world. They belong to a genus in natural history which may be termed sui generis, that is, unique, or a kind by itself. Every publication of a medical journal or a report of some research institution of some medical society carries a number of facts that are, for some reason, soon cease to be facts. Cures by the carload are discovered, specifics are unearthed, the clinics use them and issue their statistics of cures achieved by their use. No fact seems to be more uncontestable. But alas, this cure is soon forgotten, discarded, and the specific passes into limbo. Other cures and other specifics follow in melancholy succession. The medical limbo is overstuffed with the cures that did not cure. On this same subject, we had the following comment from the Optional Vaccination League of Colorado Springs. "Vaccination is a relic of the same barbaric superstition that produced the witch's brew, the cow dung poultices, the charmed stick, the urine tea, and many other vile and pernicious practices. The only reason that vaccination has survived and the others died of their own folly is the fact that vaccination is the greatest money-making concoction that has been invented by man for man's plunder. There's no monopoly on wisdom, and quite often the layman knows more about natural healing than some physicians, most physicians. Occasionally, we find a doctor honest enough to admit this fact. Dr. Peter MacDonald recently started the British Medical Association by the following statement: "We doctors are prejudiced against laymen who make a study of certain subjects and often learn more than we do in spite of all our knowledge of medicine and surgery." Well, perhaps the study of medicine has never been able to qualify as a science. All the medical treatments, drugs, and vaunted cures are unpredictable as to their effects on the patients. The patients have not one sure cure for any disease because they merely work on symptoms and not on causes, nor do they even understand the real causes of disease. They are a long way from the common knowledge of the natural hygienist, who knows that disease is not something to be cured. It is a cure. Vaccines are based on the false supposition that germs cause disease and that the vaccines are supposed to build antibodies that destroy germs. When physicians come out of the Dark Ages and find that germs have nothing to do with the causation of disease, they will realize how useless and dangerous have been all their vaccines, antibiotics, germicides, antiseptics, and other poisons, destructive drugs. But as long as the medical lords of high finance have control over the lives of the people, we can expect to see the vaccination sales propaganda continue to pour out of the public health offices and into the channels of communication, newspapers, magazines, schools, unions, churches, business houses, TV, radio, lecture hall, etc., weaving the web of entrapment to snare the people and their pocketbooks. And today we have heard the announcement of $100 million being given by the federal government towards an AIDS vaccine, which is sure to fail and cause more damage, and the whole thing is sure to produce wreckage. Now, I've been delving into the life of Jenner, and I find that Jenner is a complete fraud. His studies were fraudulent, and all his concepts were in error. And yet this thing has gotten hold on the consciousness of people in such a way that one is considered an outlaw virtually if one disputes the official doctrine or dogma. So I'm going to read to you from a very fascinating booklet called The Story of a Great Delusion by William White, and it was written in 1885. There are few matters among educated people upon which opinion is so absolute and so ill-formed as vaccination. They will tell you it has stopped smallpox and does no harm. And if you venture to question the assertion, you are set down as an abettor of those ignorant and fanatical anti-vivisectors, or anti-vaccinationists. If undeterred, you inquire when smallpox was stopped and which is the harmless variety of vaccination, you will probably be told that these are medical questions, whilst the facts are indisputable, the answer running in the line of old Casper's to little Peterkin, inquisitive as to the good of Blenheim. "Why, that I cannot tell," said he, "but 'twas a famous victory." I'm not complaining of this attitude of mind. We all accept more or less on bare authority. In the multiplicity and unsearchableness of knowledge, it is unavoidable. Some years ago, a venerable friend urged me to write against vivisection, which, he said, was working endless mischief to the public health. He would have the book published and provide whatever was requisite for my satisfaction. I pleaded prior engagements and turned the conversation, thinking how sad it was that one so good and in other respects so enlightened should be subject to so strange an illusion. I then, taking vaccination on trust as one of the numerous blessings conferred upon mankind in the course of the present century, I am therefore disposed to make large allowance for the credulous attitude of the public towards vaccination, while at the same time insisting on its correction. And for this reason, especially, that vaccination is no longer a matter of private concern. We are free to entertain what notions we please, but if we proceed to enforce them on unbelievers, we can't complain if we're required to answer our aggression or encounter rough usage. Enforced by the law of England, vaccination is related to the life and intelligence of every citizen, and it is consequently vain to claim for it exemption from common discussion. Apart from its compulsory infliction, vaccination might be and remain an esoteric rite, the very mystery of mysteries. But with compulsion, the privilege of sanctity is impossible. It's been said that beliefs and observations or observances in themselves most irrational were a different aspect when viewed in the light of their origin and history. It is so with vaccination. Had it come upon the world as we know it, with failure and disaster, equivocation and apology, rejection would have been inevitable. But when we turn to the past, we discover that our damnosa hereditas has a tradition that goes far to account for, if not excuse, the folly which remains. Vaccination was the successor of inoculation, or more precisely, variolation, entering into possession already acquired in the human mind. In fact, it wasn't, just a side note, it wasn't, well, it's sort of the modern type of what's called vaccination now, a word that is rooted in the word vaccus, the Latin for cow, and hence cowpox became vaccination. Inoculation with cowpox became known as vaccination. And in 1796, he inoculated a boy with a cowpox vaccine he had developed. But it was by no means the first inoculation in history. It's been practiced in the Orient ever since ancient times. And the Oriental smallpox had been practiced in England for the first time in 1717, when it was introduced by Lady Mary Wortley Montagu, who was the wife of the British ambassador at Constantinople. And this Turkish method consisted of taking from the pustule of an infected individual as much liquid as it had placed on the point of a pin, and scratching with it the arm of the person to be inoculated. And sometimes this inoculation ended, like today, in death. So various methods had been devised to decrease the virulence of the liquid. It was left to macerate in water for several days, or else a crust was left in water before it was used. The Chinese blew pulverized crust into the nose of the people to be inoculated. Well, the social position of Lady Mary brought the Turkish method to the British family, the British royal family, sorry, who had a dread fear of smallpox after the young and beautiful Queen Mary had died of it at the end of the previous century. But to play it safe, the king first had the vaccine tried out on six prisoners who were waiting for execution in the Newgate prison. Well, even that wouldn't have saved anyone's life. Well, vaccination so was the successor of variolation. And it had been observed from old that some forms of disease rarely recur in the same person in a lifetime. And thus, when scarlet fever or measles or smallpox broke out in a family, it was considered prudent to let the disease have its course and thereby obtain immunity from fear of future infection. It was this confidence that smallpox undergone was fully disposed of, was finally disposed of, that was the justification of the practice of inoculating the disease when introduced from the East in the first quarter of last century, that is to say, the 1700s. Inasmuch as none can have smallpox more than once, it was argued, why not induce it artificially and pass through the illness at a convenient time? But nature, though compliant, doesn't always accept the course we ingeniously prescribe for her. Smallpox is naturally developed, so to speak. It's a crisis of impurity in the blood. And if the requisite conditions are absent, it cannot be adequately excited. It is, in fact, a filth disease, and comes from confinement and dirty ways of living. Hence, variolation was an uncertain and hazardous operation. It took with some, and as they call it, it took, that is to say, it acted with some, and was indistinguishable from an attack of ordinary smallpox. It took partially, or not at all, with others, and the operation was frequently followed by malaise, disorders of the skin, and grave constitutional derangements. Nor were they virulated secure from smallpox. They occasionally had smallpox with their neighbors, and then it was said there must have been some mistake about the inoculation, for it is impossible that anyone can be successfully inoculated and have smallpox. What's more, the virulated, while laboring under the induced malady, conveyed the disease to their attendants and visitors, and thus smallpox was propagated by the means intended to avert it, or as we say, people became carriers. Well, at the close of last century, that is to say, the last of the 1700s, variolation had become the custom of the upper and middle classes of England. The trouble and the peril were disliked, but were accepted in the name of duty. The variolation of their children was an anxiety that weighed like lead on the hearts of affectionate parents, and glad and grateful they were when the operation was accomplished without serious mishap. Patients designed for variolation were dieted, purged, and bled, and smallpox from sufferers of sound constitution was diligently inquired for. Mild smallpox was in great demand and was propagated from arm to arm. When Dr. Dimmesdale operated on the Empress Catherine, he did not venture to convey smallpox directly to the imperial person. He looked out a case of benign smallpox, so-called, with which he inoculated a strong young man, and from the young man, the Empress. Unless we realize the inconveniences, the uncertainties, the disasters, and the horrors of the practice of variolation, albeit minimized, excused, and denied by its professors, we can never understand the enthusiasm with which vaccination was received as its substitute. The promise conveyed in vaccination was a relief inexpressible, bearing with it a show of reason that was well nigh irresistible. The argument ran thus: no one can have smallpox twice, and the mildest attack is as protective from subsequent attack as the severest. Therefore, it is that in inoculation with smallpox we find security. But inoculation with smallpox is an uncertain operation with dangerous issues. Here, however, in cowpox, is discovered a mild variety of smallpox, which may be inoculated with perfect ease and with no possibility of harm. And inasmuch as the mildest smallpox is as preventive of future smallpox as the severest, it follows that this gentle smallpox must serve as a full equivalent for smallpox itself. It was in this plausible shape that vaccination had an immediate triumph. The way was made straight for it, and every difficulty removed by the existing practice of variolation. Dr. W. B. Carpenter says that vaccination was more strenuously resisted at the beginning of the century than it is at this day. He's completely mistaken. Vaccination came upon a generation prepared for it, which saw in it a prescription in full accord with common sense. The entire medical profession, with a few exceptions, the king, queen, and court, were converted straight off, and Parliament and society followed suit. It was, I confess, a natural development of opinion, and we need have little doubt that had we lived in those days, we should have found ourselves shouting with the genteel mob. The limited resistance offered by vaccination was not based on physiological or sanitary science. Such science did not exist then. It was the resistance of variolators to vaccination, who were satisfied with the established practice and resented its disturbance, professing at the same time immeasurable horror at the profanation to humanity by infection with bovine diseases. Well, while we have no reason to identify ourselves with that resistance, we have to recognize the service rendered by the variolators in observing the results of vaccination. The persistence with which they traced and exposed its failures to prevent smallpox and the injuries and deaths it caused. So far as the maintenance of variolous inoculation was concerned, they fought a losing battle, but drove the vaccinators from post to post, cursed as they did so as malignant false witnesses possessed by the devil, and at last compelled the admission that their infallible preventive vaccine could not guarantee to prevent, but only make smallpox milder, a safe assertion because unverifiable, as indisputable as disputable in particular instances. Well, what was Jenner's procedure? About the matter of his prophylactic, there was from the first a curious confusion, which continues to this day. Jenner was a country doctor at Barkley in Gloucestershire, a dairy country, where the maids believed that if they caught cowpox in milking, they could never afterwards catch smallpox. Jenner, when a young man, was inclined to accept the dairy maid's faith. But when he discussed it with his medical acquaintance, they ridiculed him. They said, "We know that such is the dairy maid's faith, but we also know that it is untrue. For we know dairy maids who have had cowpox and afterwards had smallpox, notwithstanding their cowpox." Jenner was convinced and said no more about cowpox. To this point, let me draw special attention. No man knew better than Jenner that cowpox, as cowpox, was no preventive of smallpox. Toward middle life, he had what he conceived to be a happy thought. Cowpox as cowpox he had dismissed as impractical, but there was a variety of cowpox which he resolved to recommend. Cows in Gloucestershire were milked by men as well as by women, and men would sometimes milk cows with hands foul from dressing the heels of horses afflicted with what was called grease. With this grease, they infected the cows, and the pox which followed was pronounced by Jenner to have all the virtue against smallpox, which the dairymaids claimed for smallpox, or for cowpox, rather. She got that? And the pox which followed was pronounced by Jenner to have all the virtue against smallpox, which the dairymaids claimed for cowpox. So according to Jenner, then, the dairymaids were right and they were wrong. They were right when the pox they caught was derived from the horse through the cow. They were wrong when the pox they caught originated on the cow without the horse. He thus discriminated a double pox, cowpox of no efficacy against smallpox, and horse grease, cowpox of sure efficacy. What's more, in this connection, it's to be observed that farriers, the men who looked after the horses, believed that when they got poisoned in handling horses with greasy heels, they too, like the dairymaids, were safe from smallpox. So it's not cowpox, but for horse grease cowpox, that Jenner is answerable. In cowpox, he had not and could have no faith. In 1798, Jenner published his famous Inquiry, a treatise much more spoken of than read, wherein he distinctly set forth the origin of his chosen prophylactic. It was not, I repeat, cowpox. It was horse grease cowpox. He carefully discriminated it from spontaneous cowpox, which he said had no protective virtue, being attended with no inflammation and erysipelas, the blistering, the essential sequences of inoculation with effective virus, according to Jenner. So I've said that the world gave a cordial and unhesitating welcome to Jenner's revelation, but the observation requires a startling qualification. Jenner's revelation, as conveyed in his Inquiry, was summarily and ignominiously rejected, was absolutely rejected. I wish to emphasize this point. Jenner published his Inquiry in order to recommend horse grease cowpox, and what I have to say is that the public declined to have anything to do with horse grease cowpox. The origin of cowpox was scouted as an intolerable origin. It was disgusting. Why a diseased secretion from horse's heel should be more repulsive than a similar secretion from cow's teats was not explained, but as we all know, there is no accounting for tastes. Various attempts were to verify attempts were made to verify Jenner's prescription by inoculating cows with horse grease, but they ended in failure. Fortunately, it was said, in failure, for as Dr. Pearson, the chief among primitive vaccinators, observed, the very name of horse grease was like to have damned the whole thing. What did Jenner do under these circumstances? Did he confront the public and assert the efficacy of horse grease cowpox? Not he. He wanted money. He saw how the wind was blowing. He said not another word about horse grease cowpox. And as the public were eager at any price to escape from the nuisance of smallpox inoculation and disposed to substitute cowpox as a harmless substitute, why then he resolved to go in for cowpox and pose as its discoverer and promoter. I'm not making what is called a constructive charge against Jenner, but simply setting forth plain, undeniable matter of fact. I ask anyone in doubt as to what I say to read Jenner's inquiry, published in 1798, the prescription of which is horse grease cowpox, and the condemnation of cowpox, or rather, horse grease cowpox, and the condemnation of simple cowpox. Turn then to his petition for largesse, that is to say, for a stipend to keep him, addressed to the House of Commons in 1802, and what do we find? Not one word about horse grease cowpox, but this audacious assertion, that your petitioner has discovered that a disease which occasionally exists in a particular form among cattle, known by name of cowpox, admits of being inoculated on the human frame with the most perfect ease and safety, and is attended with the singularly beneficial effect of rendering through life the person so inoculated perfectly secure from the infection of smallpox. Why, that was not Jenner's discovery. That was the notion of the dairymaids, and so far as concerns spontaneous cowpox, was known by Jenner to be untrue. Yet, strange to say, the claim was in a measure allowed by the House of Commons, and £10,000 awarded to the impostor, and subsequently in 1807 another £20,000 when he had spent the whole £10,000 of his first award, which was an incredibly large sum, and what Jenner did with it is a very deep mystery indeed. So, as evidence of how completely Jenner's prescription of horse grease cowpox was put out of sight, I may refer to the treatise of Dr. Willen on vaccination, on vaccine inoculation, published in 1806, wherein all that was thought important covering the new practice was set forth. And although Jenner was freely cited, yet neither horse grease nor horse grease cowpox was referred to from the first page to the last. Instead, cowpox, after the fancy of the dairymaids, was exalted as a true prophylactic, apparently without a suspicion of its questionable character. As I've said, Jenner not only offered no resistance to this amazing transformation, but conformed to it and assumed the issue as his own. Since the public preferred cowpox to horse grease cowpox, he saw no reason why he should object, especially as the same foolish public lusted after someone to worship for their deliverance from the plague of variolation. The world resounded with praises of the immortal Jenner, the savior of mankind from smallpox. Enveloped in the smoke of such incense, it is scarcely surprising that the idol came to believe that his worshippers knew him better than he did himself. The promise of vaccination, its absolute security and harmlessness, was speedily belied. The vaccinated caught smallpox. They fell sick after the operation. They were afflicted with eruptions and swellings. They died. These mishaps were at first denied, stoutly denied, and when denial was no longer possible, it was attempted to explain them away. Excuse me, just one moment. The cowpox used could not have been genuine cowpox, but spurious cowpox. And for a while, spurious cowpox did yeoman service in the way of apology. But by and by, the excuse began to work more harm than good. Mishaps were so numerous that people became afraid of this omnipresent spurious cowpox, and to ask, what is it? And how could it be avoided? How can there be spurious pox? Who ever heard of spurious disease? Milkmen vend spurious milk. Grocers sell spurious sugar. Counterfeiters, spurious coin. But surely, cows are not to be numbered with such malefactors as producers of spurious pox. The thing was absurd on its face, and absurd it proved. When Jenner was under examination by a committee of the College of Physicians in 1806, he was pressed hard for a definition of spurious cowpox when he owned up. He knew nothing of spurious cowpox. The words had been employed not to describe any irregularity on the part of the cow, but certain irregularities... Somebody just made me lose my place. But certain irregularities in the action of cowpox on the part of the vaccinated which was to say that when he vaccinated, when the vaccinated recovered creditably and did not catch smallpox, the cowpox was genuine. But when the sequences were otherwise, why then it was spurious. Ingenious and convenient, was it not? Reverting to Jenner's suppression of the origin of cowpox in horse grease, it may be suggested he had changed his mind. But he had not changed his mind. As observed, various attempts were made to inoculate cows with horse grease, and that these attempts were failures. But subsequently, attempts were successful. Tanner, a veterinarian of Rockhampton, Gloucestershire, succeeded to Jenner's complete satisfaction. Dr. Loy of Whitby dispensed with the cow altogether and inoculated with horse grease, or horse pox, producing vesicles identical with those of cowpox. The great success, however, in this line was reserved for Sacco of Milan. From the hand of a coachman poisoned with horse grease, he inoculated 9 children, and from the virus thus engendered, operated on every side. Operator means he would cut the vein and insert some pox or virus. Writing to Jenner in 1803, Sacco said, "It is now admitted and settled that grease is the cause of vaccine, and we cannot too soon alter the designation to equine." De Caro of Vienna received his equine from Sacco and used it so freely and successfully among the Viennese that, in his own words, it became impossible to say which of the citizens were equinated and which were vaccinated. What did Jenner make of these confirmations? He was judged mistaken in asserting that the cowpox good against smallpox was derived from horse grease. Did he appeal with triumph to the evidence of Sacco and say, "Ha! You thought me wrong, but see, I was right"? Not he. He kept silence. He consented to be treated as in error. He stood by and allowed cowpox to be used in which he had no confidence whatever. No more. He consented to be rewarded and honored as the discoverer of a pox, which he did not discover, in which he had was without faith, and had at the outset of his career expressly rejected and condemned. He recognized that it was expedient for him that the connection between the horse grease and cowpox should be denied. He had his bill to settle with the English people, and it was not for him to make difficulties. When, however, he had obtained all he could expect from public favor and had got clear of London and the oppression of its savants, why then he resumed the expression of his original opinion, and still further, like Sacco of Milan, he dispensed with the cow and inoculated straight from the horse. He supplied the national vaccine establishment with horse virus. He sent it to Edinburgh. He distributed it among his medical acquaintances. He described it as the true and genuine life-preserving fluid. What more need I say? Such was Jenner. Such were his tactics. And whoever assumes his defense will assume a task in which he is not to be envied. Jenner died in 1823, and at that date, 3 kinds of virus were in use. First, cowpox from horse grease, or horsepox. Second, cowpox. Third, horsepox. These, of course, were subject to inscrutable modification and transition from arm to arm. It is the distinct sources we have to recognize. A patient intent on vaccination might have said to himself, "Which shall it be? Shall I be cowpoxed, or shall I be horsepoxed? Or shall I be horsepoxed cowpoxed?" How such an inquirer would have been answered had he said his perplexity before his medical advisor, I can only conjecture. Probably he would have been rebuked for his intrusion into matters outside his province. The little girl who quenched the skepticism of her comrade with the dictum, "It is so, for Ma says so, and if it isn't so, it is so, if Ma says so," illustrates the manner of rebuff administered to those who pry into professional mysteries. "It is for you to pay, and for us to think," is a formula by no means limited to ecclesiastics. Jenner, let me just identify ourselves here. My name is John Pranger, and this is Dynamic Health on CFRO 102.7 FM in Vancouver. And I'm reading to you from a booklet. If I can get it up on the screen here, well, it just went dark on me. Hang on. The Story of a Great Delusion, in a series of matter-of-fact chapters by William White. To continue then, Jenner was pleased to describe cowpox as a mild form of smallpox, but for what reason, outside his pleasure, he did not explain. They have nothing in common at all. Nevertheless, the suggestion has borne fruit. When virus has fallen short, it has been asked, why, if cowpox be mild smallpox, should not cows be inoculated with smallpox and a crop of virus be let? Various such attempts have been made, in which Mr. Badcock of Brighton has been especially distinguished. Mr. John Simon, writing in 1857, said, Mr. Babcock, from 1840 to the present time, has again and again derived fresh stocks of vaccine lymph from cows artificially infected by him, having vaccinated with such lymph more than 14,000 people, and having forwarded supplies of it to more than 400 medical practitioners. Unquote. Then it is remembered that virus for half a dozen or more vaccinations is taken from a single arm, and that this process of reproduction is repeated every week. Some idea may be formed of the extent to which this smallpox cowpox has been diffused over the country. The original assertion that vaccination confirmed lifelong immunity from smallpox was unwillingly abandoned under stress of experience, until no respectable practitioner pretended that lifelong immunity from smallpox was unwilling... It's remembered that virus for half a dozen or more vaccinations is taken from a single arm, and that this process of reproduction is repeated every week. Some idea may be formed of the extent to which this smallpox cowpox has been diffused over the country. The original assertion that vaccination confirmed lifelong immunity from smallpox was unwillingly abandoned under stress of experience, until no respectable practitioner pretended that the right afforded more than a partial or temporary security. In promotion of smallpox, cowpox, however, Jenner's most extravagant claims were revived. In Mr. Simon's words, for the recipient of smallpox, cowpox, quote, neither renewed vaccination nor inoculation with smallpox, nor the closest contact cohabitation with smallpox patients will occasion him to betray any remnant susceptibility to infection. Untrue even of variolation, it is unnecessary to controvert such a figment. It suffices to place it on record. The hypothesis was that smallpox inoculated on the cow lost somewhat of its virulence. But if so, why should not cowpox inoculated on man resume its virulence? We are apt to forget that the nature of things is not controlled by our wishes, and that our interest in the conversion of smallpox into cowpox and its maintenance as cowpox is no warrant for fulfillment. I may also remark that though smallpox cowpox has entered so largely into currency, there is no evidence to what extent it has displaced the preceding issues of horse grease cowpox, cowpox, and horsepox. So far as we know, they are all existent in the common blood, indistinguishable, the stronger surviving, the weaker dying out. Nobody knows nor can know. That smallpox, cowpox, is in any sense cowpox, is widely disputed, much confidence being placed in the researches of the Lyons Committee in 1855, presided over by Mr. Chavot. This commission, says Dr. Charles Cameron, proved incontestably that smallpox can no more be converted into cowpox by passing it through a cow than by stunting an oak it can be converted into a gooseberry bush. Cowpox, it is held, is a disease of the cow, with no relation to smallpox. The vesicles of each may be apparently identical, as are the vesicles excited by the application of tartar emetic, but that's no good proof of essential identity. According to Dr. George Wilds, quote, smallpox inoculation of the heifer produces not vaccinia, but a modified smallpox capable of spreading smallpox among human beings by infection, end quote. And Dr. Cameron boldly attributes the recent increase of smallpox to the use of smallpox cowpox for vaccination. Nor is Dr. Cameron singular in this opinion. Some time ago, the Galway Guardians ran short of virus for vaccination when it was proposed to inoculate a calf with smallpox. As soon as the local government board in Dublin became aware of the project, it was forbidden. Why? Here is the deliverance of the secretary. Quote, because smallpox virus taken from the calf would communicate that disease to the human subject and be thereby a fertile source of propagating the disease and would, moreover, render the operator liable to prosecution under the Act prohibiting inoculation with smallpox, end quote. Thus, the virus current in England and credited with miraculous virtue by Simon is denounced as dangerous and its use unlawful in Ireland. The constant disasters of vaccination, the certain and unsuspected communication of human diseases with the virus propagated from arm to arm, have induced a wide resort to cowpox under the designation of animal vaccination, in contempt of the fact that disease in cattle is as rife as among men and inoculable. Still, the dread of the invaccination of syphilis is so intense and so justifiable that other risks are encountered if that may be avoided. This cowpox is recommended as pure lymph from the calf, a sweet paraphrase with a savor of Daphne and Chloe, of Flora and the country green, a paragraph used in craft or ignorance, pure lymph being as incapable of producing vaccinia as pure milk or pure saliva is. The prescription takes us back to Jenner's own time and Jenner's procedure. As has been said, the Gloucestershire dairymaids believed that after cowpox, they were safe from smallpox, and that Jenner was much impressed with their belief until he discovered that it was untrue. Had he found it true, he might have advertised the prophylactic 30 years in advance of the publication of his inquiry. But if anything was certain, this was certain, that cowpox did not avert smallpox. Satisfied that cowpox, per se, was of no avail against smallpox, he defined a variety of cowpox generated by the application of horse grease, to which he was pleased to ascribe sovereign efficacy. Why, I ask, did he discriminate and prescribe that variety of cowpox if cowpox per se was effective? The question answers itself. I will not say the cowpoxers treat Jenner's evidence with disrespect, for such is their ignorance that I question if they are aware of its existence. Moreover, that which is undesirable to know is instinctively avoided and kept out of sight. They recommend their lymph as wonderfully mild, being attended with no erysipelas, the pest of arm-to-arm vaccination, a description that tallies exactly with Jenner's of impotent cowpox. The pustules, says Jenner, are of a much milder nature than those of horse grease cowpox. No erysipelas attends them, and therefore they are incapable of producing any specific effect on the human constitution. And still, incredible as it may appear, it is with the praise of this impotent cowpox, attended with no erysipelas, that the public have been deafened, and for which the most extravagant assertions are made. Dr. Martin, one of the chief producers and vendors of the article, appeared at the British Medical Association in 1881 saying, "I am called upon at times at the very shortest notice to vaccinate whole cities. And when I left America, I had just completed the vaccination of the city of New Haven. The custom is to send for me or my son, whenever smallpox breaks out, with order to vaccinate at once the entire population of the city, town, or neighborhood. It is done immediately, the result being that an epidemic is completely stopped in a week." Thus spoke the charlatan, with the acquiescence of the medical assembly. When churchmen deplore the skepticism of the age and the decay of faith, it is to be observed that the habit of mind is limited to certain modes of opinion, and that in general we are as credulous as ever. Human nature in its structure is curiously immutable. Wherein is the advantage to disbelieve in witchcraft and to believe that epidemics of smallpox can be stopped with cowpox? You're listening to CFRO 102.7 FM. This is Dynamic Health. My name is John Pranger. And we are talking about Mr. Jenner and the curse that he conveyed to the human race by his quackery. Such are the leading varieties of virus used for vaccination, starting with Jenner's horse grease cowpox, then horsepox, then smallpox cowpox, and finishing with cowpox revived, each of them inscrutably modified and transferred from child to child and from beast to beast. We are continuously hearing of miracles brought by vaccination in the past and present, especially in the past, at home and abroad, especially abroad. The assumption being that vaccination is and has been everywhere the same. On the contrary, the condition precedent to serious consideration of any vaccine miracle is a definition of the variety of vaccination practice. It is, we admit, convenient to the administrators of the right that it should pass for uniform, however multiform. For the practice has become a great and lucrative business, a worldwide poll tax, and whatever internal differences of the priesthood, it is their obvious interest to exhibit a decorous unanimity in presence of their customers. Hence, the uneasiness recently excited by indiscreet advocates of pure lymph from the cow or from the calf, which has been judiciously allayed not by resistance, but by concession and damnation with faint praise, the commercial instinct dictating caution. For if the public did get behind the professional screen and discovered the mysteries of cowpox, what might not befall the craft of vaccination? So the story of vaccination is a story of failures, and each failure has become manifest. It has been more or less artfully apologized for. Much is given to assurance. People like infallible prescriptions. They prefer an unequivocal to an equivocal answer. Thus, adventurers understand and discourse accordingly. Hence, when Jenner solicited Parliament for largesse, he did so in no doubtful terms. He boldly declared that cowpox was inoculated on the human frame with the most perfect ease and safety, and was attended with the singularly beneficial effect of rendering through life the person so inoculated perfectly secure from the infection of smallpox. Again, he said, the human frame, when once it has felt the influence of genuine cowpox, is never afterwards at any period of its existence assailable by smallpox. Well, it's needless to point out that Jenner was without warrant for his assertions. His experience did not cover more than a few years, and he could not, therefore, know that his specific would secure its subjects from smallpox for life. He believed, or affected to believe, his own assurance, and assurance being infectious, it widely spread. The inoculation of cowpox became fashionable among busybodies, male and female. Ladies especially were numbered among Jenner's favorites and experts, operating at ease, as he described, with a light hand. Cobbett relates, quote, gentlemen and ladies made the beastly commodity a pocket companion. And if a cottager's child were seen by them on a common, in Hampshire at least, and if that child did not quickly take to his heels, it was certain to carry off more or less of the disease of the cow. Unquote. It so happened that prior to the introduction of vaccination, a marked decline in the prevalence of smallpox had set in. And for the continuance of this decline, the vaccinators took credit. See, they cried, see what we are doing. But they failed to observe that the decline prevailed among millions who did not participate in the cowpox salvation. Soon, however, cases of smallpox among the vaccinated began to be reported. At first they were denied. They were impossible. When the evidence became too strong for contradiction, it was said, there must have been some mistake about the vaccination. For it is incredible that anyone can be properly vaccinated and have smallpox. The human frame, when once it has felt the influence of genuine cowpox, is never afterwards, at any period of its existence, assailable by smallpox. Either some carelessness on the part of the vaccinator or some defect in the cowpox served for a while to reassure the faithful. but ultimately these reinsurances utterly broke down. Persons vaccinated by Jenner himself caught smallpox and died of smallpox. Then said Jenner, I never pretended that vaccination was more than equivalent to an attack of smallpox, and smallpox after smallpox is far from being a rare phenomenon. Indeed, there are hundreds of cases on record, and inquiry. Oh dear, yes, inquiry, hang on, is continually bringing fresh ones to light. True, very true. But what then of the assurance and prediction under which £30,000 of the people's money had been pocketed? The human frame, when once it has felt the influence of genuine cowpox, is never afterwards, at any period of its existence, assailable by pox, smallpox. That was his promise. No more. Jenner descended even lower. He not only likened vaccination to smallpox, but to variolation. That is, to the former practice of inoculation with smallpox. And as he said, variolation was well known to be no sure defense against smallpox. Why should people be offended when smallpox in like manner occasionally followed vaccination? Why indeed? But then the promise ran, the human frame, when once it has felt the influence of genuine cowpox, it's never afterwards, at any period of its existence, assailable by cowpox, smallpox. In a letter to his friend Moore in 1810, Jenner said, cases of smallpox after inoculation are innumerable. And again, thousands might be collected, for every parish in the kingdom can give its case. And he asked another correspondent, Dunning, in 1805, is it possible that anyone can be so absurd as to argue on the impossibility of smallpox after vaccination? And this from Jenner, who had deceived the nation in 1882 or 1802 with the assurance that inoculated cowpox was attended with the singularly beneficial effect of rendering through life the person so inoculated perfectly secure from the infection of smallpox. Such was Jenner, such his inconsistency, and such the admissions he was driven to make under stress of failures, many and manifest. As vaccination failed to afford the protection originally guaranteed, various explanations were devised to enable those who had talked too loudly and too loftily to eat humble pie without painful observation. One of the commonest excuses was that if vaccination did not prevent smallpox, it made it milder. And inasmuch as no one knew or could know how severe any attack of smallpox would have been without vaccination, it was an assertion as indisputable as the reverse, namely that vaccination not only made smallpox severer, but frequently induced the disease. There are many assertions with which there is no reckoning, for it would require omniscience to check them. Let us beware of such assertions. Let us neither make them nor suffer ourselves to be imposed upon by them. Another excuse was advanced in the report of the National Vaccine Establishment in 1804. It was said the failures in vaccination appeared to result from the practice of making only one puncture for the insertion of a virus. One puncture ineffective. Why, if one puncture were ineffective, how were the miracles of vaccination to be accounted for then, all of which had been effected by means of single punctures? There was in those days a surgeon of eminence in Norwich, Edward Rigby, and he at once entered his protest against the novel doctrine. Writing to the Medical and Physical Journal of August 1814, he said, no physiological reason is assigned for this, and I believe it would be difficult to prove that a single perfect vesicle, which goes through the usual stages and exhibits the characteristic appearance of its singular disease, of this singular disease, can be less the effect of a constitutional affection than any given number would be. It cannot surely be doubted that a single perfect vesicle affords as complete security against variola as any indefinite number, and if so, there would seem to be an obvious objection to unnecessarily multiplying the vesicles, which in all cases go through a high degree of inflammation, are often attended with painful tumefaction, and even suppuration in the axilla, and if exposed in the later stages to any act of violence, are apt to assume a very disagreeable ulceration, more especially as young children, now the principal subjects of vaccination, are more liable to suffer in this way, end quote. Rigby had the better side of the argument. As he observed, no physiological reason was assigned for the recommendation of pleural punctures, nor was any such reason ever assigned. It is the rationale of vaccination that a virus is injected into the system which begets a fever equivalent to an attack of smallpox. And as smallpox rarely recurs in a lifetime, it is hoped that nature may graciously recognize a substitute for the reality. Organic poisons, such as vaccine, operate like fire or ferment. Quality is of no account. So that the fever be kindled, excess is waste. A scratch at a dissection is as deadly as a gash. One bite of a mad dog is as likely to beget hydrophobia as a dozen. The sting of a cobra may be almost invisible, but the puncture is enough for death. Sir James Paget says of vaccine virus that inserted once, in almost infinitely small quantity, yet by multiplying itself or otherwise affecting all the blood, it alters it once for all. Such is the rationale of vaccination. And if I were a vaccinator, I should hold the position assumed by Rigby and maintain that one puncture is as effective as a dozen, inasmuch as with one, it is possible to excite that fever, which is the essential of vaccination. Adding, in Rigby's words, that as one puncture is in all cases attended with a high degree of inflammation and often with painful tumefaction, swelling that means, and even suppuration in the armpits, that is to say, pus coming out of the armpits, which in case of violence are apt to pass into very disagreeable ulceration, especially in young children, it is most undesirable to increase the number of such dangerous wounds. Well, I'm afraid that that's all the time we have. I can recommend that you read this article for yourself on a website, www.whale.to. That's W-H-L-E, as in, you know, the whale, .to. I don't know what that stands for. And this is the story of a great delusion. And there is also Jenner's inquiry is posted there. You can read the whole thing. And many other doctors who, and essayists who are right at the time, Lionel Dole, Dr. Charles Creighton, MD, and also Dr. Hadwin. And I would really recommend that you go to that website and see for yourself that Jenner is a fraud and the whole of vaccination is fraud. And yet the vaccinators are busy everywhere. The Pope has gotten into the act. The federal government has gotten into the act. And Microsoft, the owner of Microsoft, whatever, Bill Gates has gotten into the act, pouring hundreds of millions of dollars into a useless method of preventing disease that is easily prevented by sound nutrition and hygienic control. Thanks very much for listening. We'll be back next week with Sue Kelly, and we're going to be talking about the human papillomavirus and all the politics surrounding it, which is seeking to, as Merck is putting pressure on governments to have this vaccine mandated. And it brings them a revenue of about $4 billion a year so far, and I guess they'd like it a little more to make up for the loss that they suffered with the deadly drug Vioxx. It's time that these people were strung from the lamppost, that's what I say. Come again next week. This is John Pranger saying, keep healthy.